On today's Biz News Briefing, Elon Musk-Donald Trump bromance ignites again, the DA hits back with no confidence motion threat, why the ANC took the blue pill, not the red one, top cops on a slippery slope, Africa's BPO boom or bust, and US markets hit record high 6 months in. Stay tuned. It's Tuesday, the 1st of July. I'm Stuart Lohman. Elon Musk has slammed the US Senate's version of Donald Trump's tax bill, criticizing its cuts to electric vehicle tax credits. He calls it political suicide for the Republican Party, Bloomberg reports.
Is it making any dent, do you think, from the political standpoint that he wants it to?
I mean, it doesn't seem to be. He's been railing about this, you know, from around the time when he and, you know, Donald Trump had their spat, you know, their public spat, which ended with social media insults and seems to still be going on to some extent. That's been going on for weeks, and it hasn't seemed to slow this bill down. In fact, you know, we've seen versions of the bill where instead of sunsetting these consumer tax credits, which make it $7,500 cheaper for consumers to buy an electric vehicle, sunsetting those 90 days from passage rather than 180 days, creating a situation where Tesla could be impacted as early as the end of this year. This would be a real challenge for a company that has already struggled with demand, especially amid all the controversy caused by Elon Musk's support of Donald Trump.
Max, you pointed out on X something that we've talked about often on the show, which is the president was quite consistent on his approach to these kinds of incentives, but so was Elon Musk. You know, he kind of regularly said, we'll do away with them because he felt that they, at least as I understand it, he felt it gave other legacy automakers a leg up that Tesla just didn't need. And now he's upset. Just give us that backstory.
Yeah, I mean, historically, Musk's position has been, we don't need the subsidies. And I think one of the reasons for that is that historically, the subsidies were going to sunset. You know, this is before Joe Biden. We're supposed to sunset once an automaker hit a specific number. That got gotten rid of, but Musk continued to say he would rather have a level playing field, which sort of made sense because Tesla was the most profitable of the companies selling electric vehicles. That is, its electric vehicles were most profitable. Now, the thing is, over the last year, Tesla's financial position has changed to some extent, right? We've been talking about these sales challenges, sales falling in China, in Europe, and so on. Meanwhile, you have other electric vehicle makers becoming more competitive. That's creating pressure on the company's finances. And I think that's one thing that has changed besides the obvious, you know, blow up between Elon Musk and Donald Trump.
But to be fair to Elon Musk here, perhaps, one thing that also hasn't changed on his part is that he's railed against the deficit and debt. So how much do we know that this is the nuance that he's really angry about, or more broadly, his view that we need to rein in spending in America?
Listen, I mean, he's railing about the debt as well. While he's tweeting about, you know, these the U.S., you know, hurting the clean energy industry, or as he sees it, he's also saying that this bill is going to increase the debt and the deficit. Of course, Musk spent months trying to work on that with Doge, and in certain ways, I guess this bill, he sees it as an affront to those efforts. You know, I think the EV policy and the clean energy policies are a big deal here, whether or not Musk specifically points to them or not, because they will affect the bottom line of the company that, you know, is most important to his portfolio.
From that bromance to South Africa's coalition, Helen Ziller has warned that kicking the DA out of the government of national unity would crash the rand, deepen unemployment, and open the door to corruption on steroids. She says they won't leave willingly, and is ready to bring a no-confidence motion against President Ramaphosa. She spoke to my colleague, Bronwyn Nielsen.
The president can fire all his ministers, so he can fire us, and there are many people in the ANC who want him to fire us. But the fact is that I think the president knows, and many of his ministers know, what the consequences will be. The rand will crash. We'll be lucky if it's 25 rand to the dollar. The economy will go into a tailspin. Investors will withdraw. Unemployment will increase. We'll probably be pushed out of AGOA. Tariffs will go up. The unemployment in the agricultural sector will soar. And South Africa will have one of those huge jolts of history that take us another level down, a big level down. And I think the more sensible people in the ANC know that. And that's why they've been very careful not to kick us out. They want us to leave. They want to do what is called a constructive dismissal on us, which is why they are doing this again and again. But no one knows more than we do what the consequences are of us leaving for jobs, for the economy, for growth, for the future of the country. We also know that Paul Mashatile would then now come in, and he's very closely involved in the lotto tender and a whole range of other things. We'd have corruption on steroids, and we'd have EFF and MK possibly in government. And after Donald Trump showed that Kill the Boer chant, sung very gustily by Julius Malema to the whole world, you can imagine the reverberations of that.
I was listening to an interview yesterday. You have said you are not going to make it easy for them to get you out of the government of national unity.
We're certainly not going to make it easy. They'd love it if we walked and then took the blame for everything that will follow. We're not going to do that. And they know that we're not going to walk out, but we're not going to be treated like a doormat either. And there are lots of steps between being treated like a doormat and walking out. The penultimate step to walking out is to do a motion of no confidence in the president. Now, we've done the sums, we've done all the adding up, and we think we can get to 196 or 197 votes to outvote the president. And that would probably succeed, because I've never seen the ANC bring all its parliamentarians into the House ever, not even when there's a three-line whip. There's always someone doing something else, shopping or in a hotel room with someone or overseas or somewhere. And so it would be very, very close if we got 197 votes, absolutely. And Ramaphosa would know that his life was on a string. And if we're not there, it's very likely that the ANC will internally recall Ramaphosa, as they've done to all of the other presidents, except Nelson Mandela. So he knows what's at stake, and they all know what's at stake. And we are going to take intermediate steps from doing nothing is not an option. We're going to take intermediate steps until such time as we have to take the big one, which is a motion of no confidence.
You can watch the full interview on BizNews TV on YouTube. An alternative to the DA coalition would be the EFF. However, the ANC Snoki Zikalala highlighted why the ANC took the blue pill and not the red one. He spoke to my colleague Alec Hogg 2 years ago.
Well, we have a framework on coalitions, and our document states very clearly of the ANC, which we influence in terms of it to be adopted, because we as Veterans League said that we cannot form coalitions without a framework. And there are seven pillars of that framework. One of them, we are saying coalitions must be based on a common minimum program, a citizen's charter that focuses on measurable targets to service delivery and development in the communities. Such a program must be made public and be subjected to discussions by the community. Secondly, we have said coalition partners must commit to shared values, values of stability, accountability, ethics, good governance, respect for constitution and the rule of law, social justice and equity, human dignity and non-racialism. The third program that we have is that the party that has won the largest votes should lead the coalition in that municipality, and execute positions and executive positions should be allocated in proportion to votes obtained by coalition partners. And so what we are saying, that you look at EFF itself, EFF does not believe in good governance, does not believe in ethical values, does not believe in integrity, does not respect the our constitution and the rule of law.
And as a result, it breaks those rules.
As a result, it breaks those rules. EFF does not respect that. But there are other parties that do respect. For instance, the DA does respect the rule of law, does respect our constitutional democracy. And so there's nothing wrong. If DA, for instance, it just got 45%, we have 44. If it said that we have a program of action, that program of action is the one that will ensure that we develop the communities, we provide services, We make sure that we provide electricity. We make sure that we get rid of potholes, refuse collection, governance. Definitely, there's nothing wrong in sitting and talking to any party that is committed to service delivery to the poor and that believes in the rule of law.
But what you've just said now would make would be harsh listening for many people within the ANC, where the DA is regarded as the enemy.
Yeah, what we are saying to our people is that we are saying that we're not opposed to working with any party, as long that party will be able to say will focus on measurable targets to service delivery and development in communities. And so we are saying that you should enter because it's all about providing services to the poor and services to society. And of course, if you enter into a coalition, into a party that believes in the rule of law, that believes in our constitutional democracy, though DA, of course, we are saying there's a red line with the DA, we know that they don't believe in transformation. And some of them are racist. But now if they say there's a common program of providing services to our people, and we agree and we are open about it, I don't think our society will object to that type of an agreement, because our people are the ones who are suffering, wherever we are. And if they are saying, if DA says we'll provide skills in terms of governance, there's nothing wrong with that, in as far as we are concerned. And so we are saying that any party, we say any party, but EFF does not believe in the rule of law, does not believe in our constitutional democracy. And you cannot enter into a coalition with such a party.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Forensic investigator Paul O'Sullivan says he's helped take down 2 police commissioners, 15 generals, and 17 brigadiers, and he's not done. He says if dirty cops aren't stopped, the rule of law collapses and the country with it. He spoke to my colleague, Chris Dane.
Paul, tell us, how many cops have you exposed and had removed from office or prosecuted?
Well, I think in the last, shall we say, 20 years, been 2 commissioners of police, 1 head of Hawks, 12 generals, and 15 brigadiers. But I can't say I was personally involved in everything that happened last week, but I was certainly gunning for those people too. And if I add those 5 generals and 2 brigadiers into the mix, it's now 15 generals and 17 brigadiers. And a whole host, I don't keep count, of all the colonels, lieutenant colonels, majors, captains, and all the rest of it. But I just want to make it clear also, it's not that I'm gunning after these cops. It's just that if I don't do it, and nobody does it, we have a broken criminal justice system. And then what? If the rule of law doesn't exist, this country's finished. And we're already having a lot of problems, major problems. I've been involved in policing in this country since the late 80s. Now, and I left the police in, I think it was 2001. And it was Jackie Celebi that forced me to leave the police. He booted me out. So that was a mistake on his side, because after that I went for him. And then I went for all the people that protected him and tried to shield him from the criminal justice system. And then I decided probably around about 2015 or so, okay, or 2013 or so, something like that, I thought, okay, you know what, I've done enough now. But then another dirty cop popped his head onto my radar screen, and I don't know, something just got the better of me, and I decided to go for him too. And up to now, I just haven't been able to stop. So I keep at it. And I think I'll probably keep at it until I'm not able to do it any longer. And the best part about it is I don't get paid a cent for any of this. In fact, it costs me money. I'm just going to close the email because with emails open, we're going to get that little dinging noise. Okay. So I don't get paid a cent. Nobody pays me for all this work. And as I made the point, it actually cost me money. It cost me quite a significant amount of money. I said, in the last 15 years, I've easily spent 15 million rand of my own money in this fight, or this crusade, as some people call it. But I've always maintained my ethics in what I'm doing. I've never done it in a way that it's unethical. If I played the game the same way they play it, or they've tried to play it, I mean, they've tried to have me murdered.
You can watch that full interview on BizNews TV on YouTube. Our Reserve Bank Governor, Lesetša Ganyahu, says a review of South Africa's inflation target is nearly complete. He also weighed in on the broader inflation outlook and the need for restrictive monetary policy, Bloomberg reports.
I am not sure that one would say that oil prices have settled, but we are comfortable with the inflation trajectory. I think the central banks have done a very good job taming the great inflation of 2022. What we didn't figure in our analysis was that there could be a shock, and that that shock would actually come from policy in the form of tariffs, but there was also a shock that comes as a result of the geopolitics. You said that the oil price has settled. It had been all over in the past few weeks.
You're right. I mean, I guess the ceasefire between Iran and Israel means that there was a little bit of comfort in the markets that we wouldn't see the spikes that we feared in those couple of days where there was a real flare-up. Governor, can you tell us what this means for a possible rate cut in July?
I think that what you should worry about is what the inflation trajectory looks like. Then you will know where rates are going. I'm just one member of that committee. I do not know the views that everybody will be holding in the committee. You go into the committee with a view, and then you must be willing to be persuaded, because the other committee members would have different views. We have a fairly robust debate. What we have had so far has been that inflation has been contained at the lower end of our inflation target range, and this actually has given us an opportunity of what central bankers call opportunistic disinflation, that which means that you use a low inflation environment to anchor inflation expectations at that level.
But Governor, for you personally, do you think there's scope to cut next month? This month?
Oh, no, come on, Francine. Of course, you know what the answer is. If you wait until the end of the meeting this month, you will know which way the rates are going.
Okay, I'm not very good at waiting, nor is the market, but we'll do that. Governor, look, the South African Reserve Bank has also made a pretty forceful argument for adopting lower inflation targets, which has been undergoing a review. Is now the right time?
Well, this work has been done, Francine. When the framework was introduced, there was always an understanding that we are going to lower the target. We did lower the target, but there was a shock, and we made a big policy mistake by reverting to the old inflation target instead of explaining that we experienced a shock and that we will come back within the target. In 2020, the National Treasury launched a macro review, and part of that macro review included a revision of the monetary policy and the inflation target. And one of the recommendations was that the inflation target should be lowered to 3%. Since then, further work had been done between the Treasury and the South African Reserve Bank. Our teams had been working very hard. They are fine-tuning the final details, and they make recommendation to the minister and the governor. What is in no doubt is that our inflation target is range is wide. Mm-hmm. It is too high. It is out of line with our peers. Mm-hmm. And we could only, if there is a revision, the revision can only be lower.
So, Governor, when are you expecting actually for that to be finalized and presented to the finance minister?
Well, the work is being done by the team. It should be very soon that is finalized. I think that it is important. We have impressed on the team. There is an opportunity right now of using, as I had said, opportunistic disinflation, and that the sooner we finalize that, the better.
But, Governor, why absolutely make sure that you have the support of the finance minister? I mean, if you say that you're aiming for a lower target, that would also do the job.
Yes, it will do the job, but these things always work because you had mobilized the whole of government and society around the target. And this particular minister is a big advocate of central bank independence, is a big advocate of prudent macroeconomic management, and it's very important that he is on board and helps us articulate that and bring society on board with respect to lower inflation.
So it's more powerful.
It's more powerful.
South African consumers look forward to that rate decision at the end of the month. Now, Africa's BPO sector is booming with a 14% annual growth forecast to 2028. Nearly double the global rate. But The Economist warns that automation threatens nearly 40% of current jobs.
Currently, just 1 million Africans work in BPO, about 2% of the industry's global workforce. Yet between 2023 and 2028, the industry is expected to grow by around 14% a year in Africa, nearly twice as fast as the global BPO growth rate of 8%. In Kenya, which hosts some of the world's largest outsourcers, the BPO growth rate is projected to be even higher at 19%, according to Genesis Analytics, a consultancy. Africa is the next frontier, says Martin Rowe, chief executive of CCI Global, whose newest call centre in Kenya seats 5,000 workers. Anglophone Africa, in particular, has always had some advantages in attracting BPO firms. Its youthful population is increasingly well-educated, with strong English language skills. Bosses claim many Western customers prefer the sound of what they say are more neutral African accents to those of Indian English speakers. The continent's time zones are convenient for businesses in America and Europe. In the past, all that was not enough to tip the scales away from Asia, yet this time may be different. Kenya's long-awaited national BPO policy, due to be unveiled in July, aims to create 1 million jobs in the sector over the next 5 years. Nigeria launched its Outsource to Nigeria scheme in 2024. Both offer generous tax breaks and subsidies. South Africa's even doles out cash grants for new jobs. The biggest challenge is AI. Many basic tasks have already been automated. A decade ago, Graham Parrott, a British entrepreneur, founded one of Ethiopia's first BPO firms, which closed during the pandemic. Now he fears the country may have already missed the boat. Bobby Varanasi, a consultant, argues that the industry is being completely hollowed out at the bottom. A report by Genesis Analytics for the MasterCard Foundation estimates that more than 40% of tasks in the BPO industry in Africa are at risk of automation. Mr. Rowe of CCI argues that there will be continued demand for more complex and emotional services only humans can deliver. That means that, in the long term, gaining a bigger share of global outsourcing may ultimately be about securing the highest value jobs. For governments, investing in education may be the best hedge against being left behind.
Wall Street closed the second quarter at record highs, with the S&P 500 up 25% since April, its best quarter since 2023. Tech led the rally with the hopes of rate cuts. Bloomberg reports.
The stock market closed at record highs on the final day of the second quarter, and the S&P is now up roughly 25% from its April lows, giving the benchmark its best quarter since December 2023. Today, the S&P broke above 6,200, with tech shares leading the charge. Sam Stovall is the chief investment strategist at CFRA Research.
Right now, the S&P 500 is trading at two standard deviations above its 20-year mean. It's more than one standard deviation above the 10-year mean.
That is Sam Stovall from CFRA speaking earlier on the Bloomberg Businessweek Daily radio program. By the way, much of the market's gains have been tied to the hope that the Fed will be resuming rate cuts. And today, Goldman Sachs projected a cut in September as the inflationary effects of tariffs look a bit smaller than expected.
There's an adage that markets go up to the right, and long may it continue. And that's it for today's show. A big thanks to the BizNews production team. And from me, Stuart Lohmann, until next time.